This is Iconic with your hosts JM, Mark, and Nick.
Welcome to Iconic, where we talk about all things 13th Age. I'm your host JM, and with me as always is Nick.
Hey.
We have another Petri's Family Game Store review for you. Today we are covering The One Ring by Cubicle 7, a Middle Earth role-playing game that is fantastic. This is one we actually went after Cam and Petri's for wanting to do a review on. Nick, give us a quick overview of what is The One Ring.
The One Ring role-playing game allows you to play set in the time frame between The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. Smaug has been defeated, the Battle of the Five Armies is over, and Sauron is gathering his power and trying to take back over Middle-earth.
So it is, if you are familiar with any of the other Middle-earth role-playing game incarnations, whether that is MERP or The Lord of the Rings one, this is unique. It has a much closer relationship with the books. Mechanically, theme-wise, than the other two. Middle-earth role-playing game was basically stripped-down Rollmaster, and The Lord of the Rings was based off the movies, not necessarily the books. So this is really tied directly into the books and the lore and the feel, both theme, art, and mechanics. So let's start talking about mechanics. How do you get things resolved in this game?
You have two different dice to roll, and your goal is to have the total presented on the dice match or exceed a target number set as a difficulty. So you have a D12 and a D6 pool that you can roll from, depending on what you're skilled in and that sort of thing. A couple of special things that are about the dice for the One Ring role-playing game is that on the D12, there are two special runes that replace the numbers. There's the Eye of Sauron rune and the Gandalf rune, replacing the 11 and 12. If you get a Gandalf rune, it's an auto success. If you get an Eye of Sauron rune, then it's an automatic failure.
No, it just counts as a zero. Yeah, but you can still succeed based off skill dice. And so then the skill dice, you get a number of D6s equal to your skill in the pool, and you add that to the total as well. Sixes have a little Tengwar rune that help indicate whether you have a regular, an extraordinary success. And also, there are certain states in the game where ones, twos, and threes on the D6 also drop to zero.
Yeah, and one of the things about this game that I really like is if you roll and you aren't high enough in your roll, then you can spend additional hope points that allows you to add your attribute, the appropriate attribute bonus to your result and to try to get it up and over. And that's something that you can do after you've tallied everything up. It's like, no, actually, I do want to succeed at this, so I'm going to spend out of this pool and make it a success.
And then the other way that task resolution is handled is that you, during character creation, have a number of traits that you can get. And unlike games like Burning Wheel or Fate, where you have to either do nothing or they modify your die rolls or change the way the die rolls happen. If you have a trait and it applies, then you succeed. So if you come to the edge of a river and there's a boat there, if one of you has, you know, boat-wise, excellent. There's no need to roll. That guy knows how to pilot the boat. It really kind of gives the characters chances to have spotlight moments, and it gives the GM a number of cues to plant those into the story to give the characters spotlight moments.
So let's talk about characters. Why don't you give us an overview of how the character creation process works and what's when you're done with creating your character, what you have as a result?
So the characters, so going into the characters for The One Ring, it is not a class and race system, although it may look like that on the surface. Your first thing is you're going to select the culture you're from, because that's really the most important part of your character. So there are six options. In the main rulebook, you can play hobbits, dwarves of the Lonely Mountain, elves of Mirkwood, bardings, Bjornings, and Woodmen. Other books have expanded this. If you get the Rivendell source book, you have the option of playing high elves or rangers, and then there's going to be a player option book coming down the line that adds even more cultures beyond that.
Cool.
The thing is, when you look at it, the One Ring core book is set very much in the Wilderland. So east of the Misty Mountains, south of the Lonely Mountains, and no further south than Mirkwood. So you've kind of got this picture of one region of the world. Rivendell expands that out into Eastern Eriador, and Rohan is coming out later this year, which will open up the area south of Mirkwood. After you pick up your culture, you pick a calling, which is really not a class. It's why you are out adventuring. Are you out there to seek treasure, to find knowledge? Do you want to protect people? Are you out there for vengeance? That kind of thing. And then, like most games, you have a number of ways to customize your character and a little bit of fiddly bits to work with. But actually, it's a pretty slick and streamlined character creation process.
Yeah, it'd be pretty easy to have you all be Bjornings, for instance, and have every character have a very different feel for it.
Yeah. One of the neat things for me, as we've talked about, is how the game feels Tolkien-like. The callings really tie into that because each calling has a shadow weakness, a way through as the game progresses. If you get exposed to the shadow or to sources of corruption, you have picked a path that your character will go down. So, for example, Treasure Hunter gets afflicted with dragon sickness. The Wanderer has wandering madness that actually ends up being like just cowardice. And there are signs that when Sauron establishes himself in Mordor that people with high shadow ratings are among the evil men who get called there. So, I mean, that ties in as well.
Yeah, I think of Boromir in Lord of the Rings and him subtly being drawn toward the power of the ring. And you can, if you watch the movies, you can see it on the screen, that shift that's slowly taking place that he's battling against. And it's that type of feel that takes place that you're able to play out at the table. One of the cool things that I do appreciate about this book and how they have presented out the characters and the character options is you end up really building your entire company of players and not just your individual characters. So many games, it seems, you come to the table with, you have your character and you have to have some reason why you just happen to meet together at the tavern. But when you're creating characters here, you're also, there's options of building your company, of defining a bit of a background, why you're all coming here together, why you're all adventuring, why you're all, you know, doing this quest. And as we'll talk later, there's many other things about this game that's very fellowship and company centric. And it's, I appreciate the fact that it's pulling that into the game right at the very onset.
Right. Well, let's go into kind of some of the broader mechanics. If you are familiar with the books, traveling and the journey is a huge part of adventuring in Middle-earth. And so there's a lot of mechanical space dedicated to how to travel, how to journey, how to plot out your journey, how long does it take. It may sound kind of boring, but when you get into it, it actually reduces down to a couple of rolls and then some GM surprises if the rolls fail. But what it does is it allows you to kind of slow the game down a little bit, focus on the fact that, no, this is actually a multi-week journey, and the party and the fellowship has to, one, figure out, do we go for speed over danger or vice versa? A lot like what you'll find at the end of Fellowship of the Ring, where they're deciding, do we go to Minas Tirith and then over to Mordor, or do we strike east? So Nick mentioned in a previous episode of kind of the D&D three pillars of play, where you have, you know, social encounters, combat encounters, and exploration. The exploration side of this game is well defined.
One point about the travel system that really complements the company and fellowship aspect is when you're going out on your travel, you define what role each person is going to play. And I think that really helps the players be invested in, I'm not just riding on the pony in the back of the line. I'm actually going to be doing something. I want to be the guide this time. Let me give that a try. And going on that way. And that ties very well into the roles that you end up playing in combat as well. When you get into combat, there's a number of things that you kind of step back from the story play and make sure certain things are in place and discuss a couple of different options. And then everyone chooses what kind of combat stance they're going to be taking. And then depending on the stance, it affects the target number of difficulty for combat resolution. It affects what types of attacks you can do, whether or not you're going to be able to run away or if you have to stay engaged and that sort of thing. And having those roles in travel and those stances in combat, I think really amplifies the cooperative nature of this game.
They also have a mechanic for social encounters that is, you know, slightly more than what you would see in normal role-playing games, but not overwhelming. You do go through an introduction, and as a GM, you set up, there's a couple of ways that a introduction can be made and you establish which this NPC is impressed with. And there is a tolerance that we're not going to get into it. There's a lot of factors that go into it, but basically you set a limit to how many failures this NPC is willing to suffer, how many blunders, how many snafus that come up. And it helps keep players' mind focus in the social encounter so that the guy who always likes to mouth off to the king, you can check that down as a failure, and suddenly the group realizes, oh, right, yeah, we're in the presence of a king. You know, yes, it's Gandalf and Aragorn going before Theoden, but they're still deferential. They're still showing him his proper respect. And again, it adds to kind of this weight of the world that settles on the game that really differentiates Middle-earth from a lot of other Gygaxian fantasy. The other thing that does this, and this is one of my favorite parts, and Nick, you can jump in here. Unlike, so when you read the books, in not only is there adventure and there's travel, but there are distinct points of downtime where the Fellowship rests and recuperates and then sets off again. And this rhythm of game is largely absent, I would say, from our traditional D&D games, where it's adventure, 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 gloss over downtime. You know, just you are murder hobos that just keep going and going and going. In The One Ring, the Fellowship phase, which can happen as often as every other adventure or one time a year, every three adventures, you set up the pace of your game, really allows the characters to take one session to rest, take some actions that have nothing to do with adventure and combat, open up new paths, open up new sanctuaries. But it gives this rhythm and a passage of years, which is something that is also very important to Middle-earth.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever played a game where there's been much focus on the downtime. I've read some stuff about maybe some older systems that there seemed to be a bit more emphasis put there. Things like, you know, buying a castle or, you know, setting up, building a tavern, setting up shop somewhere. But I agree, for the most part, it just seems like everyone kind of looks at it as the boring part of what role-playing games are. And so they end up just kind of glossing over it, whether the rules are written that way or if it's actually just played that way at the table. I do think it's kind of cool, the fact that they put such an emphasis on this, because it helps grab that Tolkien-esque feel that we've talked about. I mean, you read the Hobbit, you read The Lord of the Rings, you start out in the Shire and you end in the Shire, and it's, you kind of get that ebb and flow feel throughout the entire books.
Right, and then, I mean, they rest at Tom Bombadil's house, right. They take time at Bree, they spend, you know, a long time in Rivendell and Lothlorien. There are these respites where the people really needed just time to heal from what happened. That's one of the reasons I like Axe so much, Adventure Conqueror King, because there is a large emphasis placed on, well, what is your why is your character actually adventuring? What is his end goal? What is he spending this wealth on? But that's a little bit more in depth than, say, what you'll find in The One Ring.
Yeah. And mechanically, it answers some questions that seem to be, again, glossed over in other systems. Things like, you spend your experience points during the Fellowship phase, where you've gone home or you've found a sanctuary someplace and you've sought out someone to teach you a new skill or something like that. Whereas in other systems, you know, once you get to the next tier or the next level, wow, all of a sudden you suddenly know this new, you know, fighting maneuver or this new spell to cast. And so it kind of helps explain away some of the mechanics as well. And I like that.
Cool. Well, rounding out the book, we get an adventure, and I have run the Marsh Bell twice. As an introductory adventure to The One Ring, it is great for a couple of reasons. It covers all of the mechanics. It sets it, you know, firmly in the Wilderland, and perhaps best of all, it ties it into The Hobbit. Like, and I won't say how, but there are definitely some characters that you will recognize, some NPCs right off the bat in the Marsh Bell. Anything else in the book that you really wanted to highlight?
I gained a lot of benefit from reading the Loremaster chapter, talking about how to create your own campaign, create your own adventure, some questions to be asking yourself and going through the preparation of that, how to lay things out. And especially with a game that has such a strong following and the books have been dissected and expanded upon and talked about and movies made of them. And there's such a strong canon there that the advice that they gave about dealing with character knowledge versus player knowledge and trying to handle those players that come to you after the game or even in the middle of the game and say, no, that's not what happened. That's the wrong year. And yada, yada, yada. And you know, trying to acknowledge the validity of what they say, but also explain that, you know, this is the way that we're playing it and things aren't quite, mm-hmm. you know, they aren't hard coded. And even Tolkien in his writings, things weren't quite hard coded. And so I think there was a lot of really good information there that you could extrapolate and apply to a lot of your different gaming.
Cool.
And then kind of going along with that, there is some really good outlines of the timeline of events that take place between the two books. Really good evocative descriptions of the locations in the area as well.
Well, let's move on to likes and dislikes. For me, the first thing that grabbed me about The One Ring, in addition to being – so we're going to take the fact that it's in Middle Earth off the table and the fact that I love Middle Earth. from a role-playing standpoint, the – writer of the book, Francesco Nepotello, he did War of the Ring, which if you have played that game, it is just as evocative as the books mechanically as The One Ring. And so I was very excited that he was doing this because I'm familiar with his work and I love his game design work. Then the art started coming out, and the art and production quality on these books are above and beyond almost everything else on my game shelf. There's maybe one game line that I would say has better art than this. Yeah, The One Ring is just, it's a gorgeous book. And we've talked about my, you know, how I like the mechanics and how they tie in with the world. What about you, Nick? What did you like and dislike about the book?
I would agree with everything you've said. That I would say as a complete product, it really, I don't know, for me, it just grabs the feel mm-hmm. of Tolkien's work. It allows me, and in the games that I've played in it, there definitely was that sense that I was in Middle Earth. I was having an effect on what was going on.
It wasn't just D&D in Middle Earth.
Right, exactly. It wasn't just reskinned onto something else. It actually had that feeling like, okay, you'd have your Hobbit, Fellowship of the Ring, Two Towers, Return of the King, and the One Ring role-playing game. But, you know, it seems to be just another book of the collection. And it brought to mind one of the songs in the Fellowship of the Ring, at least a stanza of it, and it's, home is behind, the world ahead, and there are many paths to tread. Through shadows to the edge of night, until the stars are all alight, then world behind and home ahead, will wander back home and bed. And the whole adventuring phase mm-hmm. and fellowship phase, I think, are encapsulated in that song.
So if you are interested in The One Ring, you should know there's a ton of cool products out there for it. One, you got the core rule book that is now a single book as opposed to when it first came out, and it was the two books in the slipcover. Custom dice set, the GM screen, and Lake Town supplement adds Men of the Lake as a culture, and some more fellowship downtime actions. Tales of the Wilder Land ties directly in with the material you have in The One Ring. It is a series of six or seven linked adventures written by iconic guest Gareth Ryder Hanrahan. It's a great series of adventures that you can either run as a giant campaign or split up and use whenever you need to. And then you have two pairs of books, and I can't stress this enough. They really are pairs of books. Heart of the Wild is a deeper look at Wilderland. Like, it expands. It is just a source book just on Wilderland. And Darkening of Mirkwood is a multi-year campaign that ties with that. And then Rivendell is the book that looks at Eastern Eriador, and Ruins of the North is another six or seven linked adventure. I have read through Ruins of the North, Tales of Wilderland, and Lake Town, and I can say the quality on those products are just as high as the core rulebook. And then they do have a storytelling card game that comes with rules for generating adventures for The One Ring, okay, called The Hobbit the Card Game. I think it's like Tales from Green Dragon Inn. So nice. Their whole product line just ties really well together.
Very cool.
Any other thoughts on the system?
One other thing that came to mind, I appreciate, and again, I think this adds to the Tolkien feel, but the fact that the players have such a limited time frame to be playing in, and they aren't superheroes, They are going to be taking damage. They aren't going to be able to last for that long. But you as a player probably will outlast the characters themselves. And the fact that they have rules in there for extending your character's legacy, either mm-hmm. after death or retirement, you know, you get, if you continue on in some way, they pass the sword on to their child or something like mm-hmm. that. There's mechanical aspects of expending extra experience points at the beginning of your character creation, all of that. But I think just being able to, in a similar vein as Bilbo handing off the ring to Frodo and continuing on the quest and the story that was going on there, I appreciate how you can do that at the table as mm-hmm. well through that mechanical aspect. And that's not a mechanical aspect that I've seen in any of the other games that I've played, but it's something that I think would be worthwhile to bring to the table.
There's very few games that have that codified that I have played. Again, just mainly because I think in a lot of ways, Axe drew a lot from this kind of build mentality. They have legacy rules like that. So, all right. Well, if you're looking to buy the products, you can find them at your friendly local game store. You can buy them online at petriesfamilygames.com. The PDFs are available both through Cubicle 7 and through DriveThruRPG. Also, just a shout out, ask your friendly local game store if they are part of Bits and Mortar. It's a program that Petri's is a part of. So if you go in and buy Cubicle 7 or Pelgrane Press books, you get a copy of the PDF with the purchase of your book at the friendly local game store. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Well, thanks to Cam and everybody at the Petri's Family Games crew. You can check them out on petriesgames.com.
And if you ever find yourselves in the Colorado Springs area, be sure to look up Petri's Family's Games.
Well, you've been listening to the Iconic Podcast.
If you have any questions or comments, you can contact us at whitedragon@iconicpodcast.com or call and leave a voicemail at 720-924-1706.
And check out iconicpodcast.com for news, updates, and new episodes.
Thanks for listening.